Next is a meeting with disciples on January 2nd, 1995 in Boston.
Very soon, I'll be holding a seminar, Gita Nagari, and then disciples meetings. Both of them are rather structured and I'm prepared for them. But tonight is not like that. So just take it as a coming together and see what we can discuss together. What I'd like to do, though, is at some point in tonight's meeting, stop and chant around together. And I did pick a few quotes about chanting from his books. Fix our minds about the importance of chanting. I only recently got a copy of the 1994 Vyasa Pooj book. And I was looking at different offerings. And there was one by Gunagrahi Swami. It was a poem. And it was talking about the early morning hours in which he has a special communion with Srila Prabhupada. He didn't describe it in detail, but mostly it was by when he chants his rounds, and he seems to have like a special kind of meditation and Prabhupada and a feeling that this is a prime time for his relationship with his spiritual master. And he kind of describes briefly what the early morning hours were like. And then he speaks of writing in his journal at that time. And then, as we know, he's a very active preacher, head of Krishna Fest. And he says, then I'm out all day, fully satisfied, preaching. And then something about that he's waiting now for he wants to take rest to get up again and have that special meeting with Prabhupada. All the Shastras talk about the glories of Brahma Muhurta hour to the non-devotee. It's outrageous to get up an hour and a half before sunrise. Some very virtuous souls, they talk about how you ought to be up by sunrise, you know, and there's some special opportunities then. But we speak about an hour and a half before sunrise. It's really early, in the summer especially. So it's just obvious. Everything is so quiet. And it's a new chance, a new day, a new chance. And especially because we have this commitment, speaking about chanting, Japa, we have this commitment to chant every 24 hours, 16 rounds. It's very, very, very important, but it's very hard to do to fix the mind on the chanting. It seems if there's any chance that we can do it, it's early in the morning. Not that because you get up early, the mind is going to be very well behaved and just you'll be able to chant in love of God. But if there's any chance, that would be the time. So, we all should try for that. Chant. I'll be reading some about that, and we'll chant. But first, you can take a look at some of these questions. There's one by Ram Roy, and I'd like to take his question a little further than he actually asked, because I thought it was a good question. And he asked it from a certain angle, and I'd like to try to answer that and go further with it. Rather than read his whole question, I'll try to paraphrase it. He says he likes reading my free writing sessions in Among Friends, and quotes some of them, from some of them. And then he says... is this still a quote, or is he starting to speak here? Krishna is kind to give me a chance. He gives the devotees opportunities to serve him. I really believe I want to preach through this medium, this is me writing, that it's a special kind of preaching and that I have to do it in my own voice as who I really am. If some of them, meaning some of the writings, are wishy-washy, then go through that phase and keep working at them. So now he's asking, I'm seeking to know how we should follow you, Guru Maharaj, by going through this devotional process of practicing our expression of our true heart in our guru-disciple relationship. I'm sometimes afraid if my thoughts and feelings might be mixed with things unwanted to pure devotional service. I feel I have allowed myself to become overly fearful to the point where I might be in danger of being attacked by bad symptoms of impersonalism, but I don't want to be over-familiar or presumptuous. I feel myself very safe and secure to follow your footsteps in exploring the range of personal expression within the process of sadhana bhakti. If you could please give us some of your personal feelings as how you would like us, your disciples, to follow you and please you by offering our hearts as purely and as fully as possible in our relationship with you by letter correspondence and subsequently our relationship with the Lord through his deity and through the many different devotees, senior and junior devotees in ISKCON. So, starting to try to answer just on the one point about communication in letter correspondence. I would say that one shouldn't write letters to the spiritual master in this free writing manner. Just writing the first thoughts that come. This is a particular exercise which brings about many good results in writing, bringing out all kinds of thoughts and feelings. But I just sketched a little reply here. When turning to address the spiritual master, it shouldn't be free writing. It should be composed and careful. However, what you say should be honest. It may include confession, etc., but within a certain structure and the etiquette of speaking to the spiritual master. Sometimes devotees, wanting to break out of this formality of an official letter, write me or send me their diary or excerpts from their diary. And this doesn't seem to be right because the diary wasn't written to me. It was written without any idea of audience. In order to be able to write very freely for the therapeutical value of spiritual journal. And all kinds of things may come out. But then to just put that in an envelope and and send it to spiritual masters doesn't seem right. Because it's a responsible relationship and we should just go face to face and approach our spiritual master and say what we want to say in all honesty. But the diary really wasn't written as a letter to him. And so he has to kind of go through it trying to say, well, see, you're speaking very intimately to your own mind, and he's kind of peering into this intimate life of your own self. And you should choose what you want to say. As I say, it may. Then you have to deliberate. You could take something from your diary and say, you know, I've got to tell my spiritual master about this thing, you know, whatever it may be. I'm haunted by ghosts, or I think I want a bloop, or I have this terrible problem, I already did some terrible thing. Sure, that you may need to say that, but then you have to deliberately say it, not just out of a stream of consciousness. He's got to pick it up. We have to be responsible for... It also has to do with efficiency and respect for the person you're speaking to. So I guess you could say you could take some of that spirit of complete openness and put it into a letter, but it should be selected from this, the way it actually may come out of you, so that it's an actual communication. So I've answered specifically about letter correspondence. I feel this is an interesting topic, one I don't think I've addressed before. Some the implication also that because I'm doing that, does this mean that my disciples, do I have some message to my disciples by this method of writing that I want them to be very, very open and somehow or other do the same thing? I don't really think like that. I'm sharing with you the way that I write. It's a kind of an art, or it's a kind of a chosen way of living and expressing oneself. So it would be hard for me to say that, oh no, I'm doing this, but you don't do it. We're told that you can't be like that. You can't say, do as I say, don't do as I do. But if I do that, then I have a responsibility of some sort. Usually this question doesn't come up. But usually my disciples or readers, they just take it and take the lessons and as well as the openness and appreciate the result of it. But the question may also arise, well, should I also express myself in this way? I don't have a cut and dried answer. I just say it's an interesting topic. I'm giving you some of my first thoughts that I would endorse it only with all kinds of conditions and discussion about it. If you mean, could you keep a diary and could you write like that in your diary? I think that's according to the individual, but I don't see anything wrong with it. I was talking to a devotee today who was having some trouble, and I said, well, do you keep a diary? And he said, yeah, but it tends to get so self-absorbed, and just maybe it's just a false ego. So I said, I know what that's like. When I write like that in my diary, then I try to change the direction. I say, steer to Krishna, and I try to turn my thoughts to Krishna so that I am not just writing in a mundane way. So that was an example of an exchange where I could encourage a devotee to keep a diary and give some hints about how the diary can be used in a spiritual way. The person was already wanting to do that. I'm careful. I'm not trying to create a group of writers among my disciples. Even this seminar coming up is a writing seminar, but I'm not trying to teach people to become writers. But we're going to try to explore our feelings, our understanding of Krishna's verses in Bhagavad Gita through writing. And some may, after the class, go on and continue to write. So I've given two answers. One, I've answered the question about the way I write. May one write letters to the spiritual master like this? I answered that question. Now I've answered the question, well, since you write like this, should we also be writers? And I'm saying, I gave an answer to that. But I think there are more different angles about this. Also, maybe I haven't even touched on the main thing, is that he appreciates this kind of openness of heart, even if it's not a perfect presentation. You just come out with it, and one feels that he wants to be like this, but is restraining himself so much that he feels he's in just the opposite camp of impersonalism and not expressing what he's thinking. So I think I am. I am setting that example, aside from techniques of writing and so on. And I would encourage that with spiritual master or with your all devotee association, you try to be in touch with your own heart and feelings and relate to people that way. But everything has to be balanced and controlled also. Especially when we're relating to others. You can't just come out with your innermost feelings with everybody. There's that expression, somebody wears his heart on his sleeve. Some line in Shakespeare, he sings, somebody wears his heart on his sleeve for daws to peck at. And if you wear your heart on your sleeve, the crows will come and peck at it. So we can't live like that in the world. But in certain relationships where there's love and trust, we can do it. We should try to do it in this relationship, guru-disciple relationship. I feel myself very safe and secure to follow your footsteps in exploring the range of personal expression within the process of sadhana bhakti. Just the idea that the range should include things that may not at first be worthy. We may take that risk and then we may be corrected by the spiritual master. This feeling is not so good. This feeling is better. Anyone want to follow up on this topic of different repercussions to come from, or repercussions or implications of reading these the way I write in this free writing and what it may mean to you? Wrong. Okay.
Yeah, you're saying, is there any repercussions? It's a big area. There are so many things, I guess you could say, but it forces us to be honest and thoughtful ourselves. It's not necessary that we have to express it in writing. That's your chosen medium.
Right.
But and we can go along with you in your journey as you're examining yourself, we can apply it ourselves too, just to be more conscious during the day of everything that we're doing. I find for myself I'm able to apply it like that.
Yeah, conscious, introspective.
Yeah, and to just question all the little things that I'm doing, or whether I want to dance in the kirtan or not, or whatever it is, to be conscious of all the things, and then to, like, hopefully I'd be able to make them as a devotional offering better to you and to Sri Prabhupada that I get from your writing. Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Yeah, in some way, the writing may set an example that in some way, not necessarily writing, we have to be honest with ourselves and open with ourselves. That's one of the lessons. Another devotee is asking me, I was talking about being oneself, that this we have to face this, that we're a unique person, and we do a lot of things together in the temple, in the movement. We all celebrate the centennial of Prabhupada with very full of praise for Prabhupada, and everyone is in the same mood. And same with the book distribution marathon. Either one goes on the marathon or praises the marathon. And everything, we do so many things. We do it exactly the same. We have the same mindset. That's why we're this group, we're this society, we're not some other society. But within those movements, we even do physically, the curtains open, we all bow down together, we all get up together, we sing at the very same exact beat in chorus to the lead singer. But at the same time, there's each person is an individual. So there comes times when he has to see himself like that, not just one of the many, or we're all disciples of the same spiritual master. And But at certain times you have to like separate yourself from everybody else's sentiment, not go against it, but say, well, how do I actually feel about that? And what do I actually think? And what do I actually, how can I actually serve to my best capacity and feel most satisfied and fulfilled? This can sometimes catch up with you if you tend not to do it, or to even think that you have a self different from everybody else's in the group. So my expression in these writings brings up an awareness of this. Sometimes some devotees don't like to read it because of that. They think this isn't part of Krishna consciousness. Just thinking your own way. You should just think the perfect way that the disciplic succession thinks. But we're not perfect, and we are individual, so we have to face ourselves. So anyway, a devotee asked me, "Well, exactly how do we do that? And what is that real self? And how do we accept that real self, especially when it's not a perfect self?" So I was saying, it's a fact that as yet we cannot meet the individual self that is our eternal self. That's our, we have a rasa with Krishna, cowherd boy or something, and there's no trace of it now. We're covered over. So we're somebody else now. And it's not that we have no idea of self until that self comes. So you're just a lump, and then one day in some future millennium, you know your eternal rasa with Krishna. But we're something now, and it's not an entirely pleasing self, and not a perfect self. But we have to meet that self, and we have to go forward with that self. Just to give an example, when you think of who you are, we'll think of ourselves just almost like we preach to the non-devotees, that everybody here now, if I ask you who you are, you'll say, "Oh, I'm a man, I'm a woman." But you're not. You're a spirit soul. We all preach like that. But actually, when we think of ourselves, we do think like that. Right now, the women are sitting on one side of the room, the men are on the other side. And the social convention is very important, that if you have a woman's body, to some degree, you have to think of yourself in that way. I remember one of the girls, 1967, was like protesting against this and wrote to Prabhupada, "Why should I think of myself as a woman, and why should I have to act as a woman? That's for those people in Maya." And Prabhupada, I forget exactly, but he corrected the attitude and said that, yes, you're not the woman, you shouldn't think of yourself as a woman, but you must behave like this. As long as we're in a non-liberated stage, as long as we're in this material world. So that's one example, easily recognizable example, of that you have to think of yourself now in certain conditioned ways, face certain limitations. May have to do with health, a mentality, capacity, and so on. And then we realize, however, because we have the perfect philosophy, that this is not my fully developed self, taking this present self, I have to serve Krishna by this psychophysical nature in the best way I can, to purify myself and perform acts which will satisfy me so that I can stay in Krishna consciousness and make my full contribution and become purified. Doesn't mean that if you see something dirty or embarrassing that you say, "Well, yeah, that's me, and this is what I want to do this, I want to do that sinful activity, so I'll do it." We have to push ourselves beyond our present self capacity. If we see ourselves that I tend to be a lazy fellow, or I tend to be always so angry, so then don't say, "Well, that's the way I am. I'm angry, I got a chip on my shoulder. If you don't like it, I'll show you." But you say, "There I am again with the chip on the shoulder. Why am I like that? I shouldn't be like that." And you can preach to yourself. But and then eventually maybe you'll change. But some of these things, at least we have to deal with it. We may be Sometimes it's a place for humor too, not taking ourselves so seriously and just seeing who you are, this foolish person. But beneath it, you sincerely want to take to Krishna consciousness, and so you have to live with these... Well, I don't want to say you have to live with these anarthas, but at least for the time being we have to live with the anarthas and tolerate the fact that we have them and try to act in a way that we don't always have them. So this is the kind of thing that... Now we're getting beyond talking, because I write in a certain technique, should all my disciples write in this technique? We're not talking about that. We're talking about different things like this. A willingness to face your anarthas, to try to get rid of them, but to realize that you can't, that it's Krishna consciousness doesn't consist simply of saying one has to get rid of all anarthas. You may recite that, or you may preach it to somebody else, but then you still have to go through your own condition, that you still have them. And in a realistic way, get rid of them. So, I don't have any more on that, but if you want to... Okay. Ask any question. Okay. Just I'll deal with one more, and then we can turn some more to chanting. There was a question about suffering, but I need more clarification on that. It looked like a good question, but I wasn't quite sure what it meant. In your class, you mentioned the dynamics of trust. Could you speak on developing trust in the guru-disciple relationship and what are the foundations for a real relationship? You were saying how if we give to Krishna, then Krishna will reciprocate many more times than the effort we put in. So in this guru-disciple relationship, should we aspire to joyfully and fearlessly put in effort for a relationship that is both obedient and real? Well, the trust in the spiritual master is that he won't leave me, like sometimes material fathers or friends or authorities, they just leave your life, or they've in this case, the spiritual master, he falls down, he goes away, or he may stay on the scene, but he doesn't give you the thing that is really required for your liberation, going back to Godhead. These would be certainly some of the major things. Doesn't give you connection to Prabhupada and Parampara, misleads you. So you have to develop, you have to overcome fears or doubts about that. That comes gradually by experience that he's giving me the right thing. The way Prabhupada describes it, it may sound a little hard to actually realize, but he says, you know, you have to that all the tentativeness and a possible lack of trust, this all takes place before initiation, and so then as long as you have any of that, you shouldn't get initiated, and then when you're initiated, then it's all gone, and then it's all surrender. The idea of doubting the spiritual master, it's just a like completely foreign idea. You can't imagine saying something like that to Prabhupada. His answer would be very abrupt, and even angrily correcting you. What are you talking about? So then there's no question of being disciple. That one reporter asked, "Your divine grace, is there ever a case where a disciple has a different opinion than the spiritual master?" Prabhupada says, "No, not unless he's a damn fool." I know that this may occur after initiation. So we should try to build on the trust rather than dwell in the doubt. If there is doubt, it can be cleared up. But when we get initiated, we do enter a relationship in which a lot of this is assumed and has to be, or else it's not actual guru-disciple relationship. To question the basic credentials of the spiritual master, who's supposed to be your spiritual master, it's a very awkward kind of thing. But whatever it is, the spiritual master has to help. So, let's try to answer that question to some degree. What are the foundations for a real relationship? It's service. I often try to bring out that, although on the one hand I know by this type of writing and expression, I talk about things that might be considered as psychological rather than absolute. And so it may appear a little unusual for guru-disciple relationship that I share with you such things. And yet, I forgot what I was going to say. What are the foundations for a real relationship? I know what I was going to say. But I'm stressing that I don't want to deal with relative situations of my disciples. That sounds like a contradiction. But what I mean is, I can't settle marriage disputes or financial problems and even psychological problems that may require more like, I mean by psychological problems like somebody's suffering from trauma of something in childhood from their parents. It's not proper to go to the spiritual master with these things. If one would go to Prabhupada, he wouldn't treat those things. He would just give the absolute remedy. Surrender to Krishna, chant Hare Krishna, and so on. And so I don't see that we should do differently. Prabhupada was very a wise person of worldly ways too, but he wouldn't indulge in giving counseling like that. So it's not good for us to have a relationship like that. It puts me in a very difficult position, as if to be absolute about things that aren't absolute, and what do I know about all these worldly things? And why should I use my energy in trying to become completely overwhelmed by them? But the thing that we... But if we have love and trust, the thing that we can share is so valuable. You know, I may say what are like the truisms of Krishna consciousness to you, that, well, you should, my dear disciple, what you need to do is to chant Hare Krishna with real attention and devotion. But because it's coming from the spiritual master, and he means it sincerely, he knows that you want to get spiritual instruction from him, you'll take it that this is significant. He said to do this, I will do it. Not that you say to him, well, I know that already, chant Hare Krishna, but I want to know. And then you bring up again some relative problem. So the foundations of a real relationship are that you're satisfied to talk about pure Krishna conscious kind of activity, how to surrender to Krishna. There's that very wonderful purport, 10th canto, chapter 1, verse 4, Nivrtatarashir Upagiyamana. Prabhupada talks about the relationship of the guru and disciple, how they just talk about Krishna, they don't need anything else. They live in this world where only this goes on, inquiries about Krishna, talking about Krishna. And they're not interested, he said, in reading newspapers or anything, or bringing these things to the spiritual master. And then, there, out of this Krishna Katha between the guru and disciple, service develops, different service to help the spiritual master distribute Krishna consciousness, and it's so many services. And that's the foundation for a real relationship. It's definitely one of, it's like a two-way relationship, as all are. And the spiritual master becomes more enthusiastic when the relationship is really being conducted with mutual interest and reciprocation, and it can grow and grow like that. We hear that a speaker, like Sukadeva Goswami or someone, they can become more and more inspired to bring up more and more revelation, which in a sense they didn't even, they were not aware that could come from them by the association of an inspired audience, audience of one or audience of a big number. And the opposite too. They will shut off when they see they're talking to someone who has an impersonal leaning or is doubtful and so on. The disciple shouldn't think the spiritual master is a mind reader. So I said that the spiritual master gets enlivened by the audience. But the disciple, he gets enlivened too when he knows the spiritual master is actually understanding me. But if he thinks, well, he's speaking precepts, but he doesn't understand me, he didn't understand what I just said, well, give the spiritual master a break. Give him the benefit of the doubt. And maybe you weren't clear, you didn't even say it, or you thought he was supposed to know. There's one devotee, he didn't write to me in a long period of time, about 10 years. Then we had an exchange, and he was saying, and I was expressing that I was disturbed by this, and he assumed that everything was all right between us. He said, because I was always feeling right about you. And so, well, when we finally had contact again, I expressed, well, I thought you were completely gone to me. I thought you'd written me off as a spiritual master, and I said, why do you think like that? He said, I was always your man, and I thought spiritual man. And he was like affronted and even irate that I had, lost the relationship. But his anger was based, at least one of it from what he said, was that he said, you're the spiritual master. I thought you're supposed to know your disciple. I'm not some clairvoyant personality who can know what people are doing if I never hear what they're doing. So, aside from being in contact by perfunctory exchanges, as the depth of the exchanges, if someone says, you know, this is who I really am, the disciple says, and this is my actual inquiry and this, so on, then this disciple will also be more enlivened that the guru is addressing my actual spiritual question and concern. We need good hearts, both of us, and purity. And Krishna can bless the relationship. Just as Krishna can bless a project, like a temple, he can bless an endeavor, he can bless a relationship too. So our relationship can improve from what it is, can grow. We should be willing to accept this, that we have this certain relationship, and it can improve by Krishna's grace and Prabhupada's grace. Some people have scorn for the relationship of ISKCON gurus and their disciples, people who claim that they're being very loyal to Prabhupada and may see deficiencies in it. But actually, if we conduct this relationship nicely, Prabhupada will be pleased with us and he can bless us more and more so that the relationship develops into a very good guru-disciple relationship. Even if at present there are some discrepancies in it. So rather than scorn it, it should be encouraged and should develop. And that takes work, mutual work exchange. Okay, let's chant now. Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shri Vasudeva Gaura Bhaktivinoda Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare Krishna. Now let's talk about japa. I have a book coming out, Japa Walks, Japa Talks. And toward the end, I say something to the effect that, so much talk about japa. I'm getting tired of it. Let's just chant japa. So the talk about japa could become an excuse for the not doing the actual work of japa, but some talk is good. So it's like coaching or talking about the game and then you have to play or so on. Now, we've been talking about the relationship with the spiritual master. Prabhupada sometimes compares it to instructions that you get on the ground from a pilot. And you're just a neophyte. But then, the time comes, you have to go in your plane alone and fly your own plane. So we have to internalize the instructions of the spiritual master. And when we chant, then we're alone. This is like an ultimate act of being alone. We were talking about you do everything together in the group of devotees. But japa, it's obvious even externally that everyone is chanting alone. Even externally, like kirtan, we sing all together. But japa, we chant. It immediately comes out different. Except sometimes if you ask Gurukul children to chant japa, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. You have 40 children, they all chant together. Krishna, Krishna, Hare, Hare. I was reading in Hari Suri's diary that Prabhupada went to New Mayapur. The Gurukul children came into the room. So he asked them, he said, let us chant japa. And they started all chanting like that. And then it got louder and louder and faster and faster. And Prabhupada was just watching and enjoying. Hari Sori said it was not a kirtan, he said, and it was not japa either. He says. So we don't chant like that. So we're alone. And it's like now all the lessons have been given up to now, whatever, surrender, devotion, anarthas. Now let's see you chant. But I say alone. Of course we're not alone. Krishna's there. But unfortunately there's something keeping us from contacting Krishna. And that's because, unfortunately, we're not alone. It's not just the soul and Krishna, but there's somebody else is there. You know who that is? It's the mind. The mind. So I've written something about that, about begging for the nectar. I would like to instruct my mind. Raghunath Das Goswami has given me the idea that I may also pray to my mind. The mind is either a valuable friend in our service to Krishna or our worst enemy. The uncontrolled mind can destroy us, as described in the song of the Avanti Brahmana. This is the Bhagavatam, 11th canto. You know this story. These verses, they're like the conclusion of the whole story, where he suffers in so many ways, especially he gets abused by other people after he takes sannyas, because he was a mean man, and everyone gets back at him, and they're spitting at him and mistreating him as he's trying to lead the life of a hermit. So he tolerates it, and he comes to this conclusion. All the senses have been under the control of the mind ever since time immemorial, and the mind himself never comes under the sway of any other. He is stronger than the strongest, and his godlike power is fearsome. Therefore, anyone who can bring the mind under control becomes a master of all the senses. And we heard in the verse this morning, anyone who can control the mind can control Krishna, Chitraketu said. Failing to conquer this irrepressible enemy, the mind whose urges are intolerable and who torments the heart, many people are completely bewildered and create useless quarrel with others. So because you can't control your own enemy, you quarrel with others. Thus they conclude that other people are either their friends, their enemies, or parties indifferent to them. That's the end of the quote. So that I introduced that just to show the full force of this potential enemy that we're dealing with. And don't be surprised. So I've been chanting for so many years, I still can't taste the nectar. My mind is always going this way and that way. Why is it? Don't be surprised. The mind is fierce-like, is God-like, and it torments the heart, and it makes us quarrel with others. This is the uncontrolled mind. Unfortunately, my mind robs me of much of my japa time by dwelling on useless memories and imaginative trails. For example, this morning while saying the holy names, I was imagining what life may have been like on board the USS Saratoga in the war against Iraq a year and a half ago. That prolonged thought eventually led to something else and something else, all outside the range of devotional service. In such cases, prayer may be too gentle a means. We have to grab the mind back to hearing the sound of Harinam. So chanting sometimes has to be a vigorous, aggressive activity. We're not alone. We're with this wild creature. So sometimes it has to really put our foot down. I was talking about these wonderful, gentle hours in the morning. And they are so. But everything is so nice, and you go to chant. And then again, the mind is taking you off somewhere. You can say, stop. I want to hear the holy names. For a pure devotee, or rather for an ideal disciple, chanting the name of Krishna sparks off a chain reaction of meditation on the many aspects of Krishna consciousness, all amid the internal energy. Srila Prabhupada writes, as soon as there is the chanting vibration, Hare Krishna, immediately Krishna's paraphernalia, Krishna's name, Krishna's fame, Krishna's abode, Krishna's associates, everything all of a sudden becomes manifest within because he is present. To remember by reference to a context means that as soon as one hears a code word, one at once remembers all the information behind that code. Similarly, when our minds are attracted to Krishna, and then everything about Krishna, simply by hearing a little glorification of his qualities, that's the beginning of pure Krishna consciousness. So a pure devotee, he just starts in, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, and then, oh, he's just thinking of Krishna, and Krishna's pastimes, Krishna is so beautiful, Krishna, Krishna, and is simply lost in the holy name because the holy name is Krishna. When will the day come when we can chant like that with the code word Krishna setting off explosions of blissful remembrance? My dear mind, I beg you to cooperate. Only if you agree can this come about. I hope, dear mind, you will not be overwhelmed. I hope, dear mind, you will be overwhelmed with happiness in chanting so that you will admit it is not your own doing but Krishna himself and his internal energy who are appearing on our tongue. But let us cooperate to invite Krishna to appear. He won't agree to appear if all we offer him is a place of stale material memories and fantasies. Let us worship Krishna so that he will be inclined to appear. We have to keep making these hopeful prayers and not become defeated or cynical of our hopes. The mind will play that role too and say, you know I have the upper hand. I will destroy all attempts for any meditation on the holy name. So you can pray to the mind all you like, but you'll never succeed. We have to be more strong than that voice. And that strength is... Or we may admit that I don't have that strength and then call to Krishna and say, look at my dear Lord, look at this predicament. You please help me. I can't chant. I have some quotes from Prabhupada. Regarding your first question, is it offensive to think of Krishna's pastimes while chanting? I think you should know that it is not offensive, but rather it is required. One must try for the point where he simply hears Krishna and immediately all of Krishna, his pastime, his form, his quality, are in his thoughts of Krishna. This is our process. When we are full in Krishna, then where can there be any chance of Maya in us? So this is our duty, to always remember Krishna's pastimes. One who cannot remember Krishna, let him always hear Hare Krishna, and then when he has perfected this art, then always he will remember Krishna. Regarding your question, there is no such requirement that japa should be silently and chanting should be done differently. Loudly or silently, everything is all right. There is no such restriction. Only thing is, we should chant very attentively, hearing the vibration very distinctly. We have to remember to hear, be attentive to the sound vibration, instead of that mind thinking of this, then thinking of this, then thinking of this, all this maya. Rather, bring the mind, I'm saying this out loud so that you can hear, and I want the mind to be fixed on the chanting. But that attention, it's not just a mechanical thing, you have to invest your feeling in it. It's not like just a game. Remember, you may have seen films, maybe this is like an old technique, I guess. You used to have films where people would sing along. Everyone would sing some song and the words would be flashed in the film. And then it would say, follow the bouncing ball or something like that. And it would follow the words. So you can just watch, you know. Oh, say, can you see? But that's just a mechanical attention. So even if you're doing that, that's not chanting. Sometimes that's the first stage. Sometimes we do that. We have, like, here's a sign. I can never follow that because the mind can't watch the names. One is being done at a different speed than another. But anyway, such mechanical attention is, you could say, the first stage. Away from the maya trip, indulgence and trains of thought, where you're not even aware that you're chanting. You're fingering the beads and you're thinking all these thoughts helplessly. And you just, whether you may be pronouncing accurately due to force of habit, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, or not even that. Some devotees discovered they don't even finger the bead per round. They just, the beads are going through their hands uncoordinated. The mouth isn't even saying the chanting properly. That's terrible, offensive. But we may get it together that we're chanting one mantra per bead, the sound vibration sounds all right on the tape recorder, but the mind is in control and you're really not paying attention. Okay, so the next thing is pay attention to the sound. So I'm saying that's not enough either. That's just a mechanical act also. It's a subtle mechanical act. You're getting somewhere at least. You're awake, you're pronouncing, and you're not even indulging in a mental trip, you're hearing the names. So far, so good. And then now we have to not just make it all mental, but the feeling has to be there. I want to serve you, Krishna, all energy of the Lord. Oh, Krishna, please engage me in your service. please clear me of my bad habits, my lack of attention and devotion to you. Let me be a surrendered devotee. I want to do what you pleases you and not what pleases me. When can I serve you? And I know that this chanting is the first service. Why can't I see the chanting as my full service? And please reveal yourself. Feelings. They don't even have to come in words, but just feelings. I want to chant. I want to chant. Then we're starting to go further than mechanical chanting. So we have this human form of life. We have some time left. We don't know how much time we have, but we want to perfect this chanting before the end comes. And the warning is from all the great authorities that the time of death is not a time necessarily of peak inspiration. It can be the opposite, that you're so troubled by the physical condition, which is forcing the soul out of the body. I mean, I know when I get a headache, I don't chant as well as when I feel well. That day, if I have a real bad headache, or just get the rounds done because I'm supposed to do it, but I can't pay attention. And then when it goes away, oh, I'm so happy, and I think, well, now you should really take advantage of this health to chant Hare Krishna and to serve Krishna. So we have to be chanting now while we're young and healthy if we want to pass the test at the end. Because that's also, I think I picked a little quote about that. That will be the, when other things are not to be done anymore, then the chanting will be, if you've learned how to chant, then you can chant when you're not able to do other things because of old age or illness or even death. But if you haven't practiced to chant, then it'll be very difficult. That's the ultimate retirement plan. People are thinking, if I can just get a house somewhere in Florida, or if I can get my pension together. But the real thing is to plan now so that you can chant Hare Krishna. Anyone have any remarks about chanting? Why not?
It seems to me that if you get into a bad habit of chanting and learning it, you're not going to put an effort in or being very attentive. It seems like it takes a while to get back out of it. It seems like it's a cumulative thing from day to day.
Yeah.
Chanting.
Good point.
It's trying with the chanting and then it's trying to improve it. So you can't just suddenly do it.
Yeah. And that leads to the thought also that it's not an isolated act. The whole life, chanting, we chant 2.5 hours at most, or 16 rounds if you're slow. But then all the rest of the hours of the day, they need to be devotional. And then your chanting will be more devotional, and vice versa. But yeah, it only takes a day or two of a real neglective chanting, and then you have to fight back to overcome that.
Prabhupada, there's some increased mercy or allowance to chant in those odd situations, but it seems from my own experience there, I can't do that for too long before I need to regain the situation where I can channel my rounds before my whole RT. But then again, if I do that too long, I'll feel empty.
I don't have an easy solution for this, and I really empathize with what you're saying, and I admire the fact that you're trying to do both, and you should try to do both. And that strain, that austerity is appreciated by Krishna. Some Babaji's, knowing the value of chanting, wouldn't dream of traveling around trying to distribute books or even leave Vrindavan and just do what is what they consider is the maximum good conditions for bhajan or chanting. And in fact, if you went to one of them and told them this problem, they'd say, well, you should stop this book distribution. What good is the book distribution? You should chant Hare Krishna. So that's not what Prabhupada wants or Lord Chaitanya wants. So I appreciate the struggle. I don't have an easy answer for you. You have to feel it within yourself. You're fortunate that you have capacities for both and a duty to do both. It just seems like you have to pay your dues, so to speak, in one area and then pay your dues in the other area, however you look at it. And know that it's good for you, even as a chanter of Hare Krishna, to do the austerity of Sankirtan. But then there's a time when you have to protect yourself and protect your sadhana by deliberate regulation. I would hope that like on a yearly basis you can work it out, like you have your Christmas marathon and summer marathon and this time and that time, and there's like a rhythm, and that now is the time for increased sadhana and so on, and in between time and a regulated life and everything, so that sometimes, in other words, you are exposing yourself more than usual, but you know, well, I just got to do this for a certain amount of time, and then I'm definitely planning at such and such time I'm really going to maybe you'll have a time when you can increase your quota or something like that, or at least be living in the temple and getting up early. So you have to plan for that, and that will enable you to take the more risks for the book distribution also. You look for ideal situations. I remember in one period of book distributors in Chicago, and they were going to the airport. It was a day of many excesses also in what they were doing, but some of the techniques and everything. But it was still a time of great intensity of book distribution at the airport. And it was a group who lived in the Chicago temple. And they really had it down that they lived together in one room. And I'm speaking of a high control of all factors. A lot of it had to do with the fact that they were living in the temple and that they had an ideal Sankirtan spot, you know, like 40 minutes away. So they had very strict, concentrated sadhana in the morning and no nonsense. They only talked about Krishna when they talked with each other, and everything was regulated. Even if someone was interested in bhajan, he said these people are really very serious practices, but then they would put on their Sankirtan clothes, go out, and you know, push Prabhupada's books at the airport for so many hours, and then come right back into the other. So that's when your environment, if you can control your environment, where you have good book distribution, and then it's not like a huge effort to reach out for good sadhana, but it's all there. Unfortunately, it sounds like the traveling Sankirtan puts a strain on that. But that maybe can be regulated so that it's not... It shouldn't be that one is very far from the other. But your life has both, with some variation. When you're in that optimum season at Nrisimha in Washington in the spring, you can have good sadhana, can't you? Good sadhana and good book distribution, all in one place. And they go together. Someone else? We're going to meet tomorrow night? Okay. So the questions are a good way to talk. If you have some more, then give them. Okay. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.